From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Summer is a time for reflection. For example, I remember how much I liked that terrific story that ran on Only a Game last summer on the bowlers and assorted crazies who celebrated the Big Lebowski. Our story on the Pan Mass Challenge Bike-a-thon, Mussolini's swimming pool, and the Vermont 100 endurance race, and the time I threw out the first pitch at a minor league diamond. Heck, why reflect on all those stories? Let's hear them again. Ahead on Only a Game, we reprise some of our favorite features of the past year, including my conversation with Matthew Seid, author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Each summer for the past three decades, cyclists have converged on Massachusetts for a bike-a-thon that has raised almost a third of $1 billion for cancer research and treatment. But there's more to the event than big numbers. Only a Game's Karen Given attended the 2009 Pan Mass Challenge, and she had this report.
It's mid-July, and in just a week and a half, the supplies stacked to the ceiling of this Needham, Massachusetts warehouse will have been distributed to 46 towns along eight routes for the largest single-event sports fundraiser in the country. Billy Starr started the Pan Mass Challenge 30 years ago. Back then, there were no forklifts or warehouses or barcoded wristbands.
It was very modest. I mean, 1980, we had 36 riders, probably 10 volunteers. Everybody got lost. We ran out of food. The ferry didn't run. And I was ceremoniously thrown in the harbor as the alleged captain of the ship. To my way of thinking, we did everything wrong. And yet, the event was fulfilling something in there, a psychic need, a need to give back, of something that we would later call, you know, sports-oriented philanthropy.
Sure, kids have been raising a penny per free throw for decades, but setting fundraising minimums in the thousands for a sporting event that requires months of training, that was a new idea. The PMC was the first event in the country to bill participants who don't meet their fundraising goals, even if circumstances keep them from riding. So why do 5,000 people accept these terms every year? Billy Starr says riding the PMC might be charitable, but it's not selfless.
I've often said, well, you know, I'm a pretty good salesman, but ride the PMC and you'll give me anything. There is palpable energy being expended towards forwarding your success in an outdoor event, come hella high water, hail, rain, or big heat.
Riders are called clients, and Billy Starr offers them four-season service. Despite its charitable leanings, the Pan Mass Challenge is a business, part of a $3 billion industry. Dave Hesekiel, president of the Run, Walk, Ride Fundraising Council, says that industry is growing.
We've come a long way from when I was a kid, where somebody would hand you a slip of paper and say, would you give me 25 cents for every mile that I walk? The internet has become a huge tool. One can now reach out to numerous people. They can click, enter their credit card data, and suddenly they are a sponsor of yours. And that has raised the complexity of the programs, but it's also tremendously increased the opportunity.
First-time rider!
Volunteers ring a bell as Sean Garvin checks in for his first PMC. He's an anesthesiologist riding in honor of his mentor, who's being treated for cancer. As a doctor, Sean probably knows enough inspiring stories to convince his friends to give to the cause anyway. So why ride almost 200 miles to raise a few thousand dollars?
Great question, but I think it shows commitment on our part to the cause. And so once they see that you're willing to do something that maybe you've never done or something to go beyond your boundaries, hopefully it will inspire them to maybe take a few more dollars out of their pockets or their checkbook and send it our way.
Two psychologists at Princeton University studied that phenomenon. They found that a person will give 50% more money to participate in a charity 5-mile run than he will to attend a charity picnic. More significantly, donors will pledge 3 times more money to a charitable cause if the friend asking for money is also performing a task that takes considerable effort.
Thank you all for being here. Welcome to the 30th staging of the Fan Match.
Billy Starr takes the stage for an hour-long kickoff show aired live on a local cable news channel. Mike Andrews is a former Red Sox player and chairman of the Jimmy Fund at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where 100% of rider-raised money is sent. He's one of the few who's been around for all 30 years of the PMC, and he's the last person who would have guessed that the ride would raise $270 million in its first 30 years.
I wasn't sure if he was going to get 2 dozen or 3 dozen of his friends to ride. Now, I figured, you know, they're pretty much on this thing for a joyride to boot. Now, that doesn't sound like a $50,000 event, yet alone a million dollar, and now a $35 million event. I mean, it is just the most phenomenal thing that I think has ever happened in fundraising, quite honestly.
Cherry Street loved you! Welcome to Cherry!
To hear the people of Cherry Street in Wrentham talk about it, the Pan Mass Challenge might be the most phenomenal thing that's happened to their street. Every year, the riders pedal through this quiet, shady neighborhood, and every year, the neighbors come out to greet them.
What's the PMC? 1, 2, 3!
Donna Dunn is taking her picture with 2 PMC riders who've gotten off their bikes for a chat. Jamie Shear started stopping here years ago when he noticed Donna's mother, Margaret McKillop, sitting under a blue awning. She had breast cancer, and Jamie started using her photo on his thank you card.
He had stopped to see her for over 6 or 7 years, and he fell in love with her. And then when he came up over the hill last year and she wasn't here, he was heartbroken. And I had a beautiful picture for him, and he put it in his backpack, and he said, she's finally going to do the whole ride.
Jamie hands Donna a framed picture of her mom's photo set against a beautiful sunset in Provincetown. Donna shows it to her neighbors with tears in her eyes and a smile on her face.
That nice?
Yeah.
That's only one of the stories, right?
Everywhere you turn at the PMC, there's a person with a story. Under a big white tent at the 85-mile mark waits a story I've heard before. Catherine Fenollosa and I used to work together on the NPR program Car Talk. Just over 4 years ago, her son Henry was diagnosed with cancer in utero. He was delivered a month early, started on chemotherapy when he was just 27 hours old, and Catherine says if it wasn't for recent advancements in cancer treatment, he wouldn't be here today. Henry's a PMC pedal partner, which means he has a whole team riding in his honor, including the doctor who saved him and his mommy's old friend, Car Talk producer and former Only a Game senior producer, David Green.
When David sort of asked if he could ride in Henry's honor, I was so floored. It's a huge commitment for someone to undertake, and it's a lot of training and a lot of dedication and a lot of fundraising that you have to do. And for him to want to do that for Henry, I mean, what more could you ask? You know, I mean, when I was looking at the weather for this weekend, it was saying 90 degrees, and I was thinking, oh, God, David.
David's fine and grinning ear to ear when he arrives to say hi to Henry. Cindy Hale practically bounces into the tent to greet her pedal partner, Jace. Cindy rides for Team Flames, which has the largest number of cancer survivors of any Pan Mass team.
The team started 9 years ago when I was a patient, and my nurses told me if I got better, they'd get on a bike and ride with me. And 9 years later, we've raised $2 million, and we all still ride.
Billy Starr likes to say that everybody gets something out of riding the PMC, and Cindy Hale seems like a good person to ask.
What do I get out of it? It saved my life. I had 2 terrible cancers, and I got to do trial drugs thanks to money raised by Pan Mass Challenge.
And were you a cyclist before you got sick?
No. Never. I mean, never. But it's so inspiring. We have doctors on our team that they are in there saving patients' lives, and then they come out and get on a bike with us. Nurses, it's amazing.
At the day one finish line, riders swarm in by the hundreds, then the dozens, and hours later, one by one. As they get ready to bunk overnight to rest up for day two, many say they'll be riding this event until a cure is found for cancer. 8 of the 15 largest sports philanthropic events in this country benefit cancer research. So if they get their wish, there will be millions of runners, bikers, and walkers looking for a new cause for which to sweat. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
The 2010 Pan Mass Challenge will take place next weekend. The Sunday picnic I was attending on behalf of the public radio station in Rhode Island was going better than I thought it might. The rain through which my daughter and I drove to get there quit just before we arrived. I hadn't remembered bug spray, but somebody else had, and she shared. The food was plentiful and good, the company was delightful, and a good time at the minor league ballpark in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, where the AAA Paw Sox would host the Columbus Clippers, was anticipated by all. Everything was relaxed and summerish until about an hour and a half into the event, when members of the station staff began tugging at my sleeve and urging me to hurry into my car and follow them to the ball yard. Hurry? I wondered. Why? We've got our tickets, so what if we miss the first inning? It's a minor league game. There are still brownies here. Why hurry? But I was overruled. We left the picnic grounds in a short caravan. A few minutes later, our cars were ushered into the VIP parking lot at McCoy Stadium, and a uniformed guard indicated that I should park in a spot that looked decidedly unauthorized. When I got out of my car, another uniformed guy pulled me toward a gate that opened onto the field. He handed me a Pawtucket Red Sox cap and a baseball. I must have looked confused. He smiled and said, "Didn't they tell you? You're throwing out the first pitch." "I haven't practiced," I said. "Can I practice?" "No time," he said, pushing me gently but firmly toward the pitcher's mound. A few minutes later, I was climbing the mound. All around me, the crowd paid no particular attention, I hope. I swung into the awkward half-windup and delivered a meatball to Billy Wayne Bubba Bell of the Houston Bubba Bells, who might have sneered but didn't. He handled the ball in a workmanlike fashion. "We'll send you a picture in a couple of days," said the man who'd led me onto the field. "There will be evidence?" I asked. Meanwhile, Billy Wayne Bubba Bell had come out from behind the plate. He signed the ball I had tossed toward him and handed it to me. "Now you've got to have a Hall of Fame career," I said to him. "Then this ball will be worth thousands." Bubba looked at me without expression. When I got home, I looked him up and learned that he was not having a Hall of Fame career. He was a AAA center fielder hitting 190. He's hitting a little better this season, and I'm rooting for him. If he'd made the only ceremonial first pitch you ever threw look a little better than it deserved to look, you'd be rooting for him too. It's 19 minutes past the hour. It worked in soccer, but will it work in the world of Russian politics? One of Russia's most popular newspapers figured that if Paul the Octopus could successfully predict the winner of the World Cup, he could perhaps predict the winner of Russia's 2012 presidential election. So representatives of Komsomolskaya Pravda placed pictures of Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev before the soothsaying invertebrate, and Paul did in fact make a pick by pointing at one of the pictures with one of his tentacles. But representatives of the newspaper have decided they won't say what that pick was until 2 years from now, which pretty much renders this story stupid, because otherwise, never mind. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, author Matthew Side makes a case for success as a result of practice rather than prodigy. But first, Rome's major sports venue, Foro Italico, used to have another name, Foro Mussolini. The late Italian dictator built the facilities that are a model of fascist art and architecture. Foro Italico was renovated in time for the 2009 Swimming World Championships, from which Nancy Greenlees reported on the spruced-up 1930s marvel that still makes Italians uncomfortable.
Athletes and spectators arriving at Foro Italico know immediately who used to be in charge. Sarah Morgan, a docent for Context Travel, peers up at a 55-foot-tall monument.
This is the obelisk, Mussolini's obelisk, that is still very, quite obviously, Mussolini's obelisk. They haven't made any attempt to erase his name that was carved into the marble.
Mussolini Dukes, or Mussolini Leader, runs down the middle of the restored, blindingly white marble. Erected in 1932, the single piece of stone came from the Tuscan town that provided marble for many of ancient Rome's monuments. The Duce wanted to create his own forum that would surpass those of Caesar and Augustus. Morgan, who wrote her doctoral thesis on gender and sports in fascist Italy, says stepping into history served the party's contemporary needs.
Well, it was really the era that they could hark back to show Italy's greatness, and also when Rome had this empire. So they used the ideas and the symbols of ancient Rome both to inspire modern Italians to feel proud about themselves and to be enthused about the fascist project, but also almost as a way of justifying what they were doing.
The propaganda greets you every step of the way in the mosaics that stretch from the obelisk to the stadiums. Duce, Duce, Duce is spelled out over and over in the complex, designed by architect Enrico Del Debbio. And sports play a key role, too. Morgan gazes down.
Well, here are some of the sporting figures, discus throwers, who do we have, gymnasts here on the rings.
Everywhere are mosaics of muscular men engaged in Mussolini-approved sports, like fencing, javelin tossing, and hockey. Cycling isn't represented because at the time the Duce considered it a communist sport. The fascists ran their own sports leagues and banned all others. Morgan says athletics were a pillar in the party's platform.
So the fascists wanted to use sport to make Italians fitter, to project an image of a stronger, more virile Italy, and as well military preparing them for war.
But the mosaics show that Mussolini had no plans to use primitive weapons during his invasion of Ethiopia or during World War II.
For us, I think today, the curious mosaics are these ones with tanks and aeroplanes and soldiers. Okay, so it's saying finally Italy has its empire. You know, it sort of looks like an ancient mosaic, but then we have tanks in it.
In Rome's Stadio dei Marmi, Italians sing the national anthem during the recent World Swimming Championships opening ceremonies. The Allies liberated Rome in 1944, yet the city was left with this reminder. The track is rimmed with 60 white marble statues of naked gladiatorial sportsmen. A little odd for their depiction of boxers, basketball players, and skiers. Spectator Valerio Raschiatore's favorite sits apart from the others.
Hercules at the entrance, who symbolizes Rome. He's the most handsome of all.
During the fascist regime, young men about Raschiatore's age attended the attached fascist physical education academy. They marched on this field for visiting dignitaries, including Hitler. Much has changed as tonight pop star Claudio Baglioni belts out a song titled Un Solo Mondo, or One World Only. Raschiatore says this stadium is striking, but often ignored because of its neighbor. The 1960 Olympic Stadium sits a few steps away, the new point of reference for many younger Romans who come here to cheer for the city's soccer teams. Yet Raschiatore says this ancient city can't hide from its history.
Rome and its people are linked more than other Italians to fascism because the city was its power center. And so it's looked at, on one hand, for the positive things accomplished, but above all for its negatives.
I don't justify the period. I want is very clear about that. But I think for the history, for the art, it's a very good example.
That's Novella Caligaris, the first Italian ever to win an Olympic medal in swimming. She's now a painter. The silver and bronze medalist at the 1972 Games trained at Foro Italico's 50-meter indoor pool. During pre-meet rehearsals, synchronized swimmers practice in this neoclassical wonder. Their legs stab from the water in this pool that resembles an ancient Roman bath. Mosaics of seahorses and lobsters cover the deck, and the walls explode with blue prancing horses and tanned runners. But Caligaris admits that despite the facility's beauty, she didn't enjoy training here.
For Italico, for the swimmer, it's not so good because it's very dark, it's very deep, and we said like a tomb. You know, when you swim, your head is in the water, you don't can look around.
Mussolini put particular emphasis on the sport of swimming, but much to his dismay, Italians didn't take the plunge, and it's still not a swimming nation, in reaction, some scholars say, to the fascist takeover of sports in the 1930s. Piero May of the World Championships Organizing Committee has a hidden pool to reveal, across a roof and tucked between two buildings.
Vediamo la piscina pensile.
We're looking at what's called the hanging pool. Mussolini swam here during fascist times. Now, fortunately, it's a swimming school for kids because the world has changed. Thank God.
The marble pool, also decorated with mosaics, won't be used during the games. May says for years this pool and other facilities were neglected and threatened with destruction because they symbolized Mussolini's fascist regime.
Instead, the Foro was rediscovered apart from its ideology, the beauty of its architecture, its modernity, despite the era in which it was constructed. In my opinion, there's no other sporting complex in the world like Foro Italico.
Swimmer Novella Caligaris says 70 years is enough time for Italians to separate the Foro Italico from its dark history. The Eternal City has done it before.
You have Colosseum, and inside the Colosseum, the Roman give the Christian people to the lions, but never cover the Colosseum.
This weekend, the swimming competition begins, an opportunity to provide new, positive memories from Foro Italico. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlees in Rome.
Natural athletes can take up tennis as beginners in the morning and challenge the club champion by late afternoon. They can switch effortlessly to golf or fill in during an intramural soccer game without missing a step, even if they haven't previously played. Or not. In Bounce, subtitled Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success, Matthew Side argues that our understanding of the talent of the so-called natural athlete has always been imperfect, if not utterly wrong. In the book, Side argues that talent is overrated, whether we're talking about Michael Jordan or Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. When I talked with him in April of 2010, I asked him how so.
Well, what is clear to me, studying the science of success, is that there is no such thing as a shortcut. Every single person you see performing at an excellent world-class level in anything from basketball to tennis to music, they have spent a lot of time, astronomical amount of time, practicing. We all start out pretty ordinary. I was a two-time Olympic table tennis player, but I wasn't very good when I picked up a bat. But you become extraordinary through the transformational process of practice. You build new neural connections. The anatomy of the brain changes over time. Mm-hmm. And all of the people who have clocked up those hours reach world-class level.
If it's thousands of hours of practice that led Roger Federer to become a champion tennis player and Bobby Fischer to become a superb chess player, to what extent does it follow that anybody who practices a sport or studies musical composition for 10,000 hours and more can reach the highest level of achievement in that discipline?
That's a terrific question. And the answer to it is based on very detailed science, mostly compiled by Anders Ericsson at Florida State University, but he has dug down into the narrative histories of all those who have reached world-class level. But he's also looked at the counterfactual, those people who have clocked up 10,000 hours and failed to perform. But the thing is, there aren't any of those. So even those who started out not very good, the ones that we might describe as untalented, if they keep going, if they continue along this path, they eventually get there. I would just make one proviso. Of course, not everybody who's played the same amount of basketball as Jordan or the same amount of the piano as Mozart reached the same level as they do. But most of us have the potential to become excellent.
Your own specific case notwithstanding, your book, Bounce, is not lacking in generalizations. You write about life as having two paths at one point, and I'm paraphrasing, one leads to mediocrity, the other to excellence. Tell me about what determines which path various people choose.
I think there's two reasons. One, you have to care about the destination. Some people really care about becoming fantastic at basketball or becoming world-class at the piano. And if you really care, of course, you're more likely to try and get towards the destination. But the problem, of course, is en route to the destination, every now and again you're going to fail. If you believe that you have the ability to adapt and to grow, you're not going to interpret failure as a reason to quit. If, on the other hand, you believe that achieving excellence hinges on your natural talent, every time you mess up, you're going to think, well, I must lack the talent.
As you acknowledge in Bounce, even some of the most thoroughly prepared athletes who've practiced well over 10,000 hours sometimes choke. You specify Greg Norman at the Masters in 1996 when he blew what looked like a sure victory over several very poorly played holes, and Bill Buckner, who missed a single ground ball during the 1986 World Series with terrible consequences. But can you really legitimately compare those two very different circumstances?
Yeah, what happened to Buckner, it could have been a choke, but if you take, for example, Greg Norman and a whole range of other durable episodes, I think you can say that they were chokes. And it is a curious and rather unusual phenomenon, but one now, I think, that is fully explainable.
Well, please explain.
Well, when you begin in any task, so say, for example, driving a car, you exert conscious control in order to build up the neural framework supporting the skill. So, for example, you know, you're looking in the mirror, you're pressing on the gas, you're turning the steering wheel. But over time, you can do it automatically, subconsciously. The problem is when an expert performer who is able to execute something like a 5-iron to the green at a subconscious level becomes so anxious, he tries to consciously control it. He almost becomes a beginner again, and that's when you have this catastrophic decline in performance.
How do you relate your theories about how athletes achieve success to such stereotypes as Kenyans are naturally great marathoners and white men can't jump?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, and actually a kind of a politically explosive issue. But it turns out it's not Kenyans who are good at distance running. It is a very small geographical population in the Western Rift Valley in and around a town called Eldoret. And a Scottish academic, Yanis Pitsilardis, has actually taken cheek swabs from the top Kenyan and other distance runners to examine the DNA under a microscope. And he has found that there is no genetic mutation that explains the success of the Kenyan runners. Instead, he has found that what they tend to have in common is living a very long way from school with school at altitude. And so over time, running, I mean, sometimes they're running upwards of 20 kilometers a day. They've built an aerobic capacity. So again, it comes back to the culture and the environment and not the genotype.
I'm talking with Matthew Side, author of Bounce. You're listening to Only a Game. Your position on performance-enhancing drugs, as expressed in Bounce, in your book, seems to be that athletes, like the rest of us, should have complete access to any drug that can enhance our lives in any way, as long as they and we don't abuse that drug to the extent that it harms us. Have I got that about right?
You've got it absolutely brilliantly, actually, but that's a perfect summary of what I feel is the reason, of course, that people in sport want to take drugs is in order to compete more effectively. So, for example, if I take a drug and you don't take it and I come ahead of you in a race, I've gained, but at your expense. But I want to just draw a contrast here. Imagine there was some kind of an enhancement technology that could help me beyond sport. Let's say, for example, a genetic enhancement that engineered immunity to the cold. I would want to take advantage of that technology, but I would want you to benefit from it too, Bill. The enhancement outside sport, sport is what economists call a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. But the enhancements that we can get access to outside sport, better health, longer lives, and so on, I think we should grasp those genetic and biological enhancements with both hands. And I fear very much that the prevailing attitude around the world is one of fear when it comes to genetic enhancement.
Matthew, you don't limit your theory that one gains expertise through a great deal of practice to athletes and artists, where perhaps their achievements are more measurable. You talk about business people and physicians. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, I guess one thing, some of us will be in a job for 10, 15, 20 years without any noticeable improvement. My mother was a secretary, and she typed at 70 words a minute after some training, and she plateaued at that level for the rest of her life. And the reason is because she was pretty satisfied with where she had got to, and she didn't challenge herself to build up additional speed. But what we do know is when typists have been put through extra training, so they train in the way that sportsmen and women train, extending their existing limitations, seeking out advantage. They get up to 80, 90, 100, 140 words a minute, which is an astronomical improvement. And it's the same, actually, in the criminal underworld. You'll have people practicing at being better criminals and getting better and better at it. I hope very much that the theory I describe will be used by people in the right way.
Matthew Seid, a BBC commentator and columnist for The Times of London, is the author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and The Science of Success, published by Harper. The author joined me from the BBC in London. Matthew, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
When he heard two men in Greenwood, Mississippi, conspiring to steal some sneakers from a sporting goods store, Jeffrey Nixon responded as perhaps few others would have done. Mr. Nixon approached the two men and urged them not to steal the sneakers. Then he went home, took two pairs of Air Jordans out of his own collection of 25 pairs, and presented them to the potential shoplifters. Nor did Mr. Nixon stop there. Upon reflection, he donated 20 more pairs of those Air Jordans, each pair unworn and in the original box, to the Salvation Army. Mr. Nixon had been collecting the sneakers for years, but until that week, he didn't really know why. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the Dude returns. But first, July is a prime month for Grand Slam sporting events. Wimbledon and the British Open need no introduction, and of course, everyone is familiar with the Vermont 100 Endurance Race. Well, actually, that one might need a little bit of introduction. Only a Game's Doug Tribou attended the 2009 Vermont 100, and he filed this story.
It's an overcast Friday evening, and hundreds of runners, their families, and friends have gathered under a massive white tent erected in Silver Hill Meadow in West Windsor, Vermont. They're here for the Vermont 100 Endurance Run. New York City resident Bob Falk is here for a shorter race, but he has completed 10 Vermont 100s and about 20 100-mile races overall. The 65-year-old attorney says the sport has a way of defining its participants.
I have a profession, but if people ask, what am I? I'd like to think I'm a runner. And I think anybody who does this type of stuff falls into that category.
The crowd is enjoying a pre-race meal of spaghetti, rice, salad, and ice cream, and washing it down with water and root beer. Tomorrow morning, the runners will begin a 100-mile race on a hilly course, mostly made up of dirt roads and trails, through Vermont woods and farmland. An ultramarathon is any race longer than the traditional 26.2 miles. The Vermont 100, Utah's Wasatch Front 100, California's Western States Endurance Run, and Colorado's Leadville Trail 100 make up ultramarathoning's Grand Slam. Hardcore runners attempt to achieve the slam by completing all four in the same summer. Most ultramarathons feature little pavement, and Vermont 100 race director Julia Hutchinson says wet weather in the Northeast has made the course especially muddy today.
And a lot of our Jeep roads have water running down the center of them, so it's going to be a wet year, especially if it rains during the race. The horses will tear up the trail a little more than just regular running.
Yes, she said horses. Ultra running was born when people started running on foot during endurance horseback riding races. This is the 21st running of the Vermont 100 Endurance Run and the Vermont 100 Endurance Ride, one of the few remaining joint events of its kind. The races raise $20,000 to $30,000 a year for Vermont Adaptive Ski and Sports, an organization that helps people with physical and mental disabilities participate in skiing, sailing, cycling, and other activities. After dinner, runners and riders retire to rooms at local inns or to the RVs and tents lined up in the field. The course will soon be a busy place. 100 horses and riders will start their 100-mile rides 1 hour after the foot race begins. Later, there will also be 75- and 50-mile horse rides and a 100-kilometer run for humans. Just after 3 o'clock Saturday morning, runners start gathering for registration and a light breakfast. 58-year-old Phoenix, Arizona resident Dan Brendan has completed 15 100-mile races in the last year alone. He says unlike many races, ultramarathons are more about camaraderie than competition.
The big issue is, did you finish it? And even if you don't finish it, those that don't finish, they gave their all. Times really are immaterial to this. Times may be important to marathoners, but not to ultramarathoners.
The runners hail from 27 states, the District of Columbia, Canada, and England. Kathy Braga and Linda Kalinske traveled from Connecticut. It's raining, and both first-time 100-milers are wearing short raincoats and utility belts that would make Batman jealous.
We have everything from goo to Enduralites to Perpetuum powder. We do have some toilet paper.
Chapstick.
We have
Glide.
Eye drops.
Flashlight. Bug spray.
Yeah.
The 236 runners line up for the 4 a.m. start. It's still dark, so most are wearing headlamps.
3, 2, 1.
The runners head downhill on a dirt road into the darkness. Yellow plastic plates with black arrows nailed to trees and fence posts mark the course. Every few hundred yards, a small glow stick hangs from a tree branch over the middle of the trail. Most 100-mile races require ultra-running experience, usually finishing a 50-mile race in 12 hours or less, and at least 8 hours of volunteer work at another ultramarathon. By midday, the sun is out. The temperature is in the upper 70s, but the humidity is low. The course has 29 aid stations. Most provide food, water, and supplies, and each has a name. Runners pass through 10 Bear Station at mile 47 now and will be back at mile 70. As runners, riders, and horses arrive, volunteers and supporters cheer them on. 10 Bear is one of the stations where runners must weigh in. Dr. Robert Rinaldi is the Vermont 100's medical director.
We weigh them before the race, and we've calculated their weights. We don't want them to lose more than 5%, If they're between 5 and 7%, we give them a warning.
Rinaldi says after a loss of 7% body weight, a person is pulled out of the race. A runner approaches limping. Rinaldi examines Annette Bednoski's foot. He determines she has tendonitis and advises Bednoski to drop out, but leaves the decision up to her. It's the Jefferson, North Carolina resident's first Vermont 100, but she's run 66 ultramarathons and is determined to keep going.
I know it's going to get hard, but I mean, until I can't move or until I put myself or someone else in danger, then there's no reason to stop. That's the way I look at it.
By Saturday evening, most of the horses have finished and are being fed and washed. The finish line is just across the field from where the race began. Runners are allowed to have a pacer for encouragement after mile 70.
Way to go!
Jack Pilla crosses the line with an official time of 16 hours, 36 minutes, and 21 seconds. Coming off two consecutive third-place finishes, Pilla says his first win is a satisfying accomplishment.
And for an old guy, too.
And how old are you?
51. So I beat all the youngins.
So you're getting better with age?
Yes, getting wiser. Yes.
Pilla is the oldest Vermont 100 winner. He lives in Charlotte, Vermont, and he's also the first Vermonter to win the run. The second runner comes in nearly 45 minutes behind Pilla. The first female, Canadian runner Stephanie Case, finishes in 18 hours and 36 minutes, ninth overall. Only about a quarter of the field earns a belt buckle, the traditional ultramarathon award for finishing in under 24 hours. Many spend all night and most of the next morning trying to beat the 30-hour cutoff, and only 173 of the original 236 succeed. Cramping, injuries, or dehydration force some to drop out. Arlington, Virginia resident Carolyn Williams dropped out at mile 56. She has completed other 100-mile races, but has never made it past 95 miles in four tries here. Still, Williams says she'll definitely be back.
I don't look at the distance, per se, you know, although it is a number, but I look at being out there. I just love the experience of running into the night and then seeing the next sunrise.
Sunday before the awards ceremony, the slow and fast eat side by side, sharing stories of aches and pains, favorite scenery along the trail, and times they thought they wouldn't make it. Among them is Annette Bednoski, the runner diagnosed with tendonitis at mile 47. Bednoski forged ahead and finished in just over 21 hours, with a purple foot and ankle to show for it. She says though she's had faster times, this finish will always stand out in her memory.
I'm just really pleased and have so much gratitude for my pacer and for the organizers here that were just so encouraging. They didn't say, no, you fool. They said, go, go, go if you can.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
This year's Vermont 100 was held July 17th and 18th. Winner Andy Jones Wilkins of Ketchum, Idaho, finished in 16 hours, 1 minute, and 40 seconds. Bend, Oregon resident Cami Semek came in at just over 16 hours and 42 minutes, setting a new course record for women.
Girls, to show you what a moon can do, moonlight on the mile.
Simply say the names of certain characters from sports, movies, and a film reel's worth of memories spring to mind. Rocky, or for those who prefer the little guy, Rudy. Others aren't quite so memorable. Rod Tidwell is best remembered as that annoying football player played by Cuba Gooding Jr. Somewhere in between superstardom and obscurity is the dude for whom a multi-city Speed of Sound tour is held each year. Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder attended the Big Lebowski Fest in L.A. in 2009, and he had the story.
If you don't have like a boot or a dark sole shoe, you don't have to get forward to that with jellies, flip-flops, what have you.
So it's 9:30 on a Friday night at Cow Bowl Bowling Alley near Long Beach, California. And Lebowski Fest co-founder Will Russell addresses a long line of Big Lebowski fans who wait patiently for league night to end, so they can come inside and do some bowling.
We get eight on a lane, so make friends and share lanes.
But Russell's speech is abruptly cut off when a Cow Bowl regular tells him to be quiet. League night isn't over yet, And Vernon Adams, a local sanitation worker who has nothing to do with the Lebowski Fest, is one strike away from a perfect string. Adams knocks over all 10 pins for a total of 300. His feat will be the night's greatest athletic achievement, by far. But most of the 900 Lebowski fans, or achievers as they're called, don't witness it. Most are in a line that extends outside and around the corner of the building. The ones already inside are hobnobbing with like-minded Lebowski fans. Many, like David Gerard, are dressed like their favorite character. Gerard, he's the dude, the movie's protagonist played to slothful perfection by an unkempt Jeff Bridges. Gerard wears a bathrobe, dark sunglasses, and sports long hair. He's a dead ringer for the dude, and knows the movie inside and out.
I could do it line for line with the music. I could do it right now.
Could you really? What, can you just give me like the first five lines of the movie? Star Trek has its conventions, Rocky Horror its audience participation screenings, but the Coen brothers' 1998 film The Big Lebowski has its fest, a two-night celebration that culminates in this late-night bowling party. The dude's social life revolves around the sport, hence the location, and according to co-founder Will Russell, Cal Bowl is a better venue than the fest's first one, a Baptist-run alley in Russell's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky.
They wouldn't let us drink, and they wouldn't let us cuss. There was actually signs that said, no cussing, no drinking. Another sign that said, please read signs above all the signs.
Russell and co-founder Scott Shuffit originally held the Lebowski Fest as a joke, but the idea quickly caught on and has grown rapidly in its 7 years. This summer, there will be 15 fests from San Diego to Boston. Russell says as the ball keeps rolling, the fest just gets better.
I mean, it just continually gets weirder and more awesome and just bigger and crazier. And, you know, we just try to keep it ridiculous, and it seems to be working.
Consider the Reverend Oliver Benjamin, a.k.a. the Doodly Lama. He started Dudism, a religion based on the dude's character. He set up shop tonight in front of a row of lockers where he's ordaining Dudist priests. That's right, Dudist priests.
It means that you've basically committed yourself to following the way of the dude. You take her easy in all sorts of difficult situations, and you're basically a pretty nice guy to everybody. And you just don't take life that seriously.
So far, Benjamin's ordained 40,000 Dudist priests, all of whom became members of his church, the Church of the Latter-day Dude. The religion even has its own symbol, a modified version of the yin-yang, but instead of one dot inside each swirl, there are three, so it looks like a bowling ball. He tells me that Dudism and its tenets of low-impact living are more relevant today than ever.
One of the problems, one of the reasons that we're in these difficult, these dire straits, is because of conspicuous consumption and people investing in things just to make money rather than buying things they actually need.
Although the Coen brothers' dude might not be much of a consumer, that hasn't stopped organizers from selling T-shirts, posters, and bumper stickers, printed with some of the movie's popular lines, like, "Mind if I do a J?" and "Not on the rug, man," a reference to a beloved scene where an intruder urinates on the dude's favorite possession. And while the dude is a decidedly non-competitive dude, that hasn't stopped Lebowski Fest organizers from including numerous contests in tonight's festivities. There's a trivia contest held in Cal Bowl's karaoke bar.
What is the name of the restaurant that the dude and Walter have coffee at?
That's all you got? Johnny's.
That is correct. Good job.
There are also contests for most original costume and farthest traveled, in this case, London. But the grand finale is a one-frame bowling match between the contestants that most closely resemble the dude and three of the movie's supporting characters. After the dude and Walter lookalikes tie, it comes down to a bowl-off. The dude knocks down 9 pins. Then, it's Walter's turn.
Oh, gutterball!
Afterwards, I talk with the winner, dude lookalike Rick Unger, an artist who describes his work as improbable realism. He wears a big wool sweater and carries props from the movie, a briefcase, cell phone, and pager. If David Girard was a dead ringer for the Dude, Rick Unger just walked off the screen.
My brother saw the movie before I did. He says, you have to go see this movie. It's all about you. So I went to see the movie and I went, oh, it's about this lazy old hippie. That is me.
But he's not lazy when it comes to looking like the Dude.
My main competitor's name is Tom. Won in 2006. I won Best Dude here in 2007. Last year in San Francisco, he beat me because I was about 35 pounds heavier than I am now, and my hair was too long and it was blonde. And when I saw the pictures, I went, no wonder I lost. I looked more like Walter than I did the Dude. So I lost the weight, cut my hair, and I'm back.
And now, at 2 in the morning, he carries with him the ultimate trophy for a Dude impersonator, an oriental rug, just like in the movie. It's rolled up and tucked under his arm. And as Unger shuffles through the automatic doors into the empty parking lot, he keeps a firm grip on it. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Lakewood, California.
Take a woman like your kind to find the man in me. But oh, what a wonderful feeling.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Parati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from the captivated McCoy Stadium crowd as I throw out the first pitch at that Paw Sox game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
Take a woman like you to get through. Man in me. La 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 la.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.